wave equation. So this is 2.5, the wave equation. Solutions of the wave equation describe, I should write it down first. Our equation 1, we're going to refer to this a lot today, d by dt squared u minus Laplacian u equals 0. This is Laplacian in x, and so I want x to live in n-dimensional space, and t is a real number. Some physicists think t sometimes should be a complex number. Let's not do that. T is real for us. What does u represent? So what does u of x, t, a solution, represent? Well, this equation comes up all over the place. It's a gorgeous equation. It's one of my favorites, to tell you the truth. It comes up in propagation of light. We're seeing light. This is essentially tantamount to Maxwell's equations, as I showed you, at least in a vacuum, as I showed you day one. Comes up in sound waves. So I'm talking to you, and those sound waves more or less satisfy the wave equation. If in the fluid, it's even a bit more complicated, and a fluid is almost incompressible, but a little bit compressible, and sound waves move very fast, but still it describes sound waves in a fluid. Gravitational waves. Some supernova explodes, and there's a disturbance, which, at least far away from it, is small compared with everything else, just travels through the vacuum on our space-time manifold, and at least locally, when it's very small, satisfies things like the wave equation. It's lovely. Many other phenomena. As I said, it's one of my favorite equations. We already had on the blackboard that this is considered, at least as I'm giving it now, an initial value problem. So an initial value problem. And what are we given? We're given the initial displacement, ux0, as some function f of x, which is specified. And often people talk about that as being the initial position, sort of like a dynamical system. This is the initial displacement or initial position. So how should I say that? Initial position. And we specify, normally we specify, d by dt of u, what that starts as. It's second order in time, so you can imagine the count would be you need two to describe, you need to specify two data. And this often is called the initial velocity, really the initial momentum, although I've sort of set mass to one in this problem. I'll put these in quotes, initial position, initial momentum. And from that, you're supposed to solve the equation. So this is a... We've been working freely with the Fourier transform. Let's do that with this equation. So let's do the following. Let's assume that, just for the moment, the f of x and g of x are Schwarz class, just so we don't have any spatial behavior or any spatial derivatives to bother us. No issues. And part of that assumption is going to be that u of x, t, also is going to be Schwarz class in x. So I'll say that Schwarz class in x variable. Schwarz class on R and the x variables, parameterized somehow by time. What I want to do is take the Fourier transform of the equation. Okay, so let's do that. There's the equation. Let's take its Fourier transform. So that's my equation number 2. D by dt squared. T is a parameter in this consideration. So I'm taking the x Fourier transform. So Fourier transform commutes with two t derivatives, at least for u and Schwarz class. And I'm simply going to get u hat of c and t. Minus, now let's see what happens when you commute the Fourier transform through Laplacian. What happens to the derivative of a function under Fourier transform? Turns to I times C, right? So just to recall that d by dx of u hat function of C is equal to I C. U hat. See, did I get the sign right? Then I get the Laplacian is minus, so the minus turns into a plus here, C squared U hat C T. And that has to be equal to zero. It's an ODE. So an ODE, this is our usual thing in this chapter of the course. ODE parameterized by C in R N, the Fourier transforms variable, the dual space to X. And we can read off its solutions, which are E to the I, etc. So solutions. U hat of C T is equal to linear combinations. I shouldn't write this yet. Solutions are linear combinations of E to the plus I modulus of C T and minus. And which linear combinations? Okay? So which linear combination? Let's decide that. We have to adjust this to be the initial data. So I need U hat C 0 is going to be the linear combination of plus or minus I C T, which gives me F hat. And I also want U hat at 0. Yeah. So U hat at 0, I want the linear combination to be F hat, so that's going to be cosine. With a moment's thought, you say cosine of KT F hat of C, which has zero time derivative when T is equal to 0. That's the property of the cosine. It's even in T. But when I take the time derivative and I look at U hat, it has to have something to do with G hat of C. And that, of course, will be the sine modulus of C T over C. Take a T derivative, out comes a C, which cancels. At T equals 0, that gives you G. And so therefore, we have an expression for U hat. Expression for U hat. U hat of C and T is equal to, just I took the sum. I don't even have to write this. This is it. But of course, then I have to look at U of xt, and that's going to be the inverse Fourier transform of this. Question. Yes, question. I was going to ask you a question, but you first asked me a question. Assume that F and G are Schwarz class. That with their data, so we can assume that you gave me data which is Schwarz class. However, I also assume that U, too, is Schwarz class, because I'm using that in the argument. So that's a little bit cheating, because I haven't proved it. So a posteriori, I'm going to prove it. Okay? I'm about at that step. Thanks very much. One sec, and I'm going to do it. You're all ahead of me. So let's get U of xt. And now I know the inverse Fourier transform if the result is reasonably good, like Schwarz class or at least L2. So I'm going to write this down, and then I'm going to come back and examine this box. So the inverse Fourier transform, 2 pi n integral, e to the I c dot x. And I'm sorry, I can't fit it all in one line, so I have to move over here. This is a continuation mark, integral, cosine, C, T, F hat, C, plus sine, C, T, over C, G hat of C, close parenthesis, D, C. From last time, we know this is well defined as long as the integrand is, well, at least L2. I'm going to argue the integrand is Schwarz class. Let's do that by inspection. F is Schwarz class, therefore F hat is Schwarz class. Does cosine CT, is that also Schwarz class in C? What's the issue? It's oscillating, but oscillating function times a very rapidly decaying function still rapidly decays. Depending on the oscillation, but if the oscillation is, it's oscillating with frequency t, but t is fixed, right? Oscillation doesn't grow at large time. So that's okay. How about the modulus of xi? Is that a smooth function? Remember I had e to the mod x. E to the minus mod x decayed rapidly, but it's not Schwarz class because at zero it has a corner. So here is mod xi. Anyone want to comment on that? My statement is this is Schwarz class. Please comment. Let me articulate that, but that's exactly the point. Cosine of xi t, cosine is a function of the square of the argument. 1 minus x squared over 2, etc. So xi squared is a smooth function, as xi has the square root, which is not. Sine is an odd function of the argument, but you're dividing by xi, so only even powers enter. You could also say it this way, that xi is a parameter in the ODE, which enters the ODE smoothly, because there's a xi squared, and so therefore the solution has to depend smoothly on that parameter. So it's guaranteed. We just did it by hand, but it's guaranteed to enter smoothly. So therefore this is Schwarz class. Good. Thank you very much for your help. Let's also observe that. What did I want to observe again? Observe that this expression, 1, 2, I better give it a name, this is expression 3, say, is well-defined for, that is, did I have to demand that F and G be Schwarz class? Not necessarily. It looks as though 3 and then its inverse Fourier transform here. It looks as though those are, let's call this even 4. Boy, I got a little cramped here, and it makes it uncomfortable to look at. But anyway, this is expression 4. The expression for you are well-defined, but not just for F and Schwarz class. What I need, for example, is that the integrand be in L2. And that will be true if F hat is in L2, and G hat over xi is in L2. So it's still well-defined for F in L2, that means F hat in L2, well, let's just say F hat in L2, and G hat of xi, even over xi, is in L2. Although those don't even necessarily possess derivatives. It's a sense, one sense of a weak solution. So, a weak solution. Meaning that if I insist upon that, I can put it in here, and this will satisfy 2. This will satisfy 2. Okay? Weak solution because I have not, a typical function in L2 does not have derivatives. And so we cannot expect U to have any derivatives because F, in some sense, doesn't have any derivatives. Nonetheless, it solves the differential equation here. For each xi, it will solve this equation. You have to worry whether it solves that equation because that takes derivatives. Okay. That takes derivatives. This one doesn't. But at least it solves this equation. One sense of weak solution. One sense of a weak solution. So here's a theorem. I just want to state that all in a box. So we've learned that for F and G in Schwarz class, the formula gives U of XT a solution of the wave equation. We've also, by inspection, learned that this solution is also Schwarz class. And I want to say, when F hat and G hat of xi over xi are simply L2, then expression 4 gives a a weak solution of the wave equation, meaning that 2 is satisfied. I'll say it that way. It gives a solution of 2, which is a weak way of saying, without actually having to take derivatives, that 1 is satisfied. Okay? Next item, energy conservation. So there's a sense of energy of a solution, which maybe we should put in quotes because we haven't really specified what U is, but in many cases, the true physical energy of a solution is going to be this, or at least proportional to this. So I want to say what, if I have a solution U, or if I have a function, then I can define its energy to be the following thing. Integrate over Rn, d by dt, I guess I need a function U of x and t. It may be a solution, but then I can always define an integral. I take this function, x of t, square it. That's like the kinetic energy. And then I add dx of U of x and t. Now that's a vector because dx is a vector, and I square it dx. I'm going to define that to be the energy. And the statement is, this is now 5. And the statement is, well, theorem 2, which is for F, G, that pair in, well, I want F to be in L2. No, I don't. I want F to be in H1. In X. I want G to be in L2 in X. What does H1 mean? You remember that? One derivative is in L2. Little note. I'll put that down. I'll put it in a second. Then one, there exists a solution because theorem one says there is one. Because this works, this satisfies this. Then the solution from what you might say theorem 1 satisfies that the conservation of energy, that is, satisfies the energy of U of xt is equal to the energy of U at x0 for all times, of course, including time equals 0, but including other times too. And because I said that about H1, I just want to recall that, what did I say? F has to be in H1, so F is in H1. That's the same, that's just a name for saying that it's a way of saying that, well, it's square integrable, and if you take the derivative of f of x squared dx, that's what it means to be square integrable, but also you can take its derivative and square that, and that's also integrable. The square of the derivative is also integrable. Okay? And because of our knowledge of the Fourier transform, this is saying that the integral of f hat of xi squared times xi d xi is less than infinity. So this is equivalent. Okay? And I want to make I'm going to prove this, but I want to make a small note. And that is, theorem 1 is valid for more functions than those of finite energy. Because f hat, the class of f hat in L2 and g hat c over c in L2 includes the class f hat c times c in L2, which is this, and g hat of c in L2, includes Schwartz. So we have solved we've already solved the wave equation for functions which have infinite energy. But if it has finite energy, then finite energy is preserved. That's the statement. Okay, and let's prove this. Oh, I just thought of a joke. We could do our physicist proof. Have I done the physicist proof for you yet? We can do it again. I once got a homework set back with a physicist proof. And this goes as follows. Well, if it weren't true, oh, this is reducto ad absurdum. I think I already told you this joke. Reducto ad absurdum. If it's not true, that's absurd. Therefore, it has to be true. Or you can modify that as the mathematician's version, which is, if it's not true, then the physicists wouldn't look at this equation, and then mathematicians wouldn't be interested in this equation, so it wouldn't be on a blackboard. That's sort of the argument for why life exists, because if it didn't exist, we wouldn't know it. Okay, let me be a little more serious and give a real proof. And I'm going to say that I want to write this formula. I'm sorry I made formula 4 in such a messy spot, because we're really living off of that. I want to write the formula, but not necessarily just for you. I want to write it for the vector dxu dtu. And let me point out that this is a... How many components does this vector have? 1 and n, because x is a vector, right? So this is an n plus 1 vector. And I want to write that. This is a solution to the wave equation given by this expression. I want to write that down. So let's do that in the following way. I'm going to run into space problems already, so I'm going to say equals. This will help my space problem out. 1 upon 2 pi root n. I'm starting to write that expression. E to the I c dot x. And now I need to write this down in Fourier transform. So I'm going to do that in the following way. cosine c t. I'm going to write a matrix. Sine c mod c t times I c over mod c. Close. Applied to I c f hat c g hat of c. Close. Dxc. And now I have to write the bottom line, which is going to be Ixc over mod Xc sine Xt cosine Xt. So just have to check it at home. If I take the x derivative of this, it brings down an Ixc, which is going to appear here and here. And if it appears here, I tag it onto the S, and if it appears here, I just leave it. And I take a T derivative, which turns the cosine into a minus sine, and the sine into a cosine. And they're appropriate factors of Xi. And those are worked into this as well. And that's how you get the formula. Okay? And this, what I want to say is that this is a vector in L2. Isn't that what I said? That CF is an L2 and G is an L2. So this is a vector, CF is an L2 and G is an L2 of R, N. But since it's a vector of N plus 1 components, I'll just say this is N plus 1 copies of L2, one for each term. Yes? Yeah, because d by dt of u is a scalar. It's just a scalar function and a time derivative of it. But d by dx, x is a vector, so actually that's the gradient. I could write nabla or del or whatever, but I'm trying to keep consistent notation. So partial x is a vectorial object. If we're in one dimension, which is a non-bad place to be, you can take away the vertical lines and put parentheses if you want. Okay? So this is an L2. Now, what does this do to an L2 function? Let's say let's say furthermore, let's say the following, that let's say the following, that I want to measure the energy. Where did I put the energy? The energy. So one way to write the energy, I'll write twice the energy is equal to integral of dTu squared dx plus the integral mod dxu squared dx. And that's like saying dTu, the L2 norm squared, plus dxu, the L2 norm squared. And that's like saying it's the L2 norm of this, what can I say? I'm being redundant here. dTu hat L2 squared plus ixc u hat squared L2, right? Which is like saying, by Poincaré, which is like saying I need to take the vector size of this thing, but because of Poincaré, all I have to do is take the vector size of this thing. So that's like the L2 norm of this matrix, cosine CT, sine CT, sine CT, cosine. I should invent a better notation because I have to do a lot of writing, and I have to fill this in, ixc over xc, and ixc over xc. Close, I f hat, ixc f hat, and g hat, all of xc. Oof, L2 c norm of that squared. And now one more item. What does this matrix do? It's unitary. Unitary, it's a complex rotation, preserves the length. So this is equal to ixc f hat of xc, g hat of xc, measured in L2 norm squared, which is the energy when you put in, well, let me write it this way, which is simply by saying it's g of L2 squared, that's the analog of that, the kinetic energy, plus d by dx f of L2 squared, which is the analog of that. So we're done. And all we've used is we started out with finite energy. So let me note, that we could have done this a slightly different way if we actually knew we had two derivatives. I don't even know about any derivatives. Well, an H1 is that's a weak sense of weak solution. But if F and G, how do I want to say this? Let me say it this way. If U is actually twice differentiable as well as finite energy, then there's an alternate proof. Meaning I gave a proof which used only finite energy. I don't even need two derivatives, but if we had two derivatives, we can use them. So let's try this, because it's instructive. D by dt of the energy. Well, the energy is one-half, it's the d by dt of this thing, one-half integral dtu squared plus mod dxu squared dx, which is equal to, now let's use the chain rule, one-half integral, let's pass the derivatives through the integral sign with impunity, argue later, twice dtu dt squared u, that's the first term, plus twice dxu dot dx dt dx, maybe. dt dx u dx. Cancel the twos. Is equal to integral dt u times dt squared u. Well, that's one term. Plus, I have a dx and a dt dx u. And this is a dot. So this is a gradient dot the time derivative of the gradient. Let me integrate by parts in x, which will leave me Laplacian u against the d by dt u. So let's use that second factor here, minus from the integrations by parts. But I know u is a C2 function, which satisfies the wave equation, so this has to be equal to zero. It's a classical method. That's how you usually derive conservation of energy. Good. Let's reduce, restrict ourselves. I mean, our theme has been Fourier transform methods, but let's violate that yet again and use some other method. So let's do that starting over here. So what I want to talk about is the D'Alembert formula. Anyone know what era D'Alembert lived in? I think it's 17th century. Is that right? So that means I want to restrict a dimension n equals 1. And what I'm going to do is derive an explicit formula for solutions of the wave equation. This constant coefficient wave equation over all of Rn. In fact, I want to say that explicit formulas exist for all dimensions. They get a little bit more complicated for dimensions 2 and higher. In fact, they're easier in odd dimensions, harder in even. Some people say that's why we live in 3 dimensions and not higher. I think that's speculative. But it's fortunate that we do live in an odd dimension, odd space dimension. But it's certainly easiest in 1. In any case, we're going to come back to those formulae, which are called spherical means formulae, in a while. But I want to give you the D'Alembert formula now, if not before. So in dimension n equal 1, the wave equation is dt squared u minus dx squared u, where this x is a scalar. X is in R1 equals 0. And then I'd like to specify again, when t is equal to 0, I want u to be f, and when t is equal to 0, I want u dot, or d by dt of u, that function, to be equal to g. Those are my two data points, so to speak. That's my position in phase space. I'll come back to that statement. Okay? And then I want to write an expression down for u. So when we had scalar first order wave equations, we had characteristics. So I'm going to do a similar thing, just sort of waving my hand, or just sort of by, what do you say, pulling it out of a hat. In this case, too, but I have to do it a change of coordinates which does two correct characteristics, not just one. So let's just do it like this by introducing characteristic coordinates. As follows, that x plus t, I want to call that r, and x minus t, I want to call that s. And then if I do that and I see what happens to derivatives because of this, I get d by dt minus d by dx turns into twice d by dr, and d by dt plus d by dx turns into minus twice d by ds. I think that's the minus sign is right. And then if I do that, oh, let's make a little picture. Can people see here? No. A little picture. Here is x space and t space. And now instead of, and those are the coordinate lines. These are the x equal constant, the t coordinate lines, and these are the t equal constant, x coordinate lines. But now I want to choose coordinates which are rather at 45 degree angle. And then this is the, let's see, R, x plus t increases along here, so that's the R axis, and this is the F axis. Okay, and now what happens to my wave equation? Well, it's the fortunate thing that d by dt and d by dx commute, and I can rewrite the wave equation as d by dt minus d by dx applied to d by dt plus d by dx applied to u equals zero. And then I look up at my table, and that's like saying 4 or minus 4 dr ds u is equal to zero. And that's like saying, let me say it this way. Actually, I switched them around. Let me do that. D by ds, d by dr, you don't mind. And that's like saying that the minus 4 doesn't matter. So that's like saying d by dr u is independent of s, because its s derivative is equal to 0. So d by dr u is some function v of r. Right? Because it's independent of s. And that says u itself is the integral of v of r, say from r, from 0 up to r of little v of r, v of r prime dr prime, plus an integration constant, plus w, right? But w can depend on s, because that wasn't the issue. It was the derivative which was independent of s. The integration constant can depend on s. And now I want to just give it, so that's a function of r and possibly s. That's why I didn't put the variables down. I wanted to surprise you. And now I'm just going to call this another nice name, which is capital V of r plus capital W of s. So that says u as a function of r and s is vr plus w of s, but how about in original variables? That says u, I'd rather call it u of x and t. I maybe even should have called it a different name, because it's a sort of a, I mean, it's the same function but in different variables. It could have been a different name, but let's not bother with that. U of x and t is equal to v, what's r? X plus t, it's a v of x plus t, plus w, what's s? X minus t. That's interesting. That's interesting, and let's just think for one sec about that decomposition. This says that solutions of our wave equation in one dimension, which I think is equation, this used to be equation 1, but we've counted already up to 8 so far, so it's equation 8. Solutions of 8 decompose into two components, which you can think of as waves, two waves. A left moving v of x plus t and a right moving w of x minus t. And let's see what, and let's see what I want to do. How about a picture? Picture's always nice. So here's x, and here's t, and then I give some initial data. I don't want to talk about that quite yet, but let's look at what the solution is along this line. Well, there's let's look at what the v component is. At xt here, there's a blip to do with v, right, that is a function only of this is the point x and t, so this is the point this is the point x plus t when t is equal to 0. See, so that's the left moving bit. And of course, let's take another point and call that, say, x1 T1, and I want to look at the right moving bit. I'm cheating a little bit. I guess I should have, let's not do this extra point, but let's get myself a little room here. There's also something adding on to this. I'm going to add these two functions. Let's pretend there's also, you add those two, there's also a point x minus t, 0, and that contributes this bit. You see? And then they're interfering, and then they'll go off. And then later on, this blip will keep on going. Whoops, I'm hiding it under the board. At a later time, t. And then this will go off and be a blip going like that. And that's moving in that direction, that's moving in that direction. See that? Pretty clear. It's very clear. What we haven't done yet is found out what capital V and capital W have to do with the initial data. So let's put in what it means to have solved for the initial data. So the question is, what is the relation with the initial data? Well, let's see. I need u of x0 to be equal to f of x, and d by dt of u at x0 is equal to g of x. That's what the initial data is. But I have u in this expression, so that says the following thing. Let's compare them. I think I need to take the derivative of u. So let's do that. Let's see. So what I need is u of x, well, let's do the following. I want to rewrite that. I should have written it here. U of x0 is equal to, from this expression, it's v of x plus w of x. So it's v of x plus w of x. And that's what's supposed to be equal to f of x. And d by dt of u at x0 is equal to, well, a t derivative of v is v prime of x. Plus, now what's the t derivative of w of x minus t? It's minus w prime using the chain rule. So it's v prime minus w prime of x. That's supposed to be equal to g of x. And now I want to solve for v and w in terms of g, f and g. And that's not so great yet because these are primes and these are nots. Well, that's pretty easy to solve. That says that d by dx, I just take the x derivative of u on the top line. D by dx of u is equal to v prime of x plus w prime of x, and solve away, and that's supposed to be equal to f prime of x. So now we'll solve the latter two, and that says that f prime plus g is equal to twice v prime, so v prime of x is equal to f as twice v, ouch. Twice v prime of x is equal to f prime plus g, f prime of x plus g of x, and twice w prime of x is equal to f prime minus g. And now let's work on that. Well, let's carry over onto this board. So that's saying that v of x is equal to, well, I only know v prime here, so let's integrate it up. It says 1 half f of x plus the integral from the reference point, why not 0, to x, g of x prime, dx prime, plus some integration factor. And it says also that w of x is equal to 1 half f of x, right? Oh, I forgot the half. Plus 1 half minus 1 half from same point or another point, why not same point, up to x, g of x prime, dx prime, plus another integration factor. And then let's just add them. Let's figure out what C1 plus C2 is. Let's just add them. Yes. Someone wants to help. Let's just add them. So V plus W, this cancels this. This is C1 plus C2. This is F. So V plus W is equal to U. V plus W at the origin is equal to F. So C1 plus C2 is equal to 0. Okay. And now let's put in the expression for V. Now I just found what V and W are. Let's put in what U of X is. That's the last thing. So U of X T is equal to, well, that's the second to the last thing. The last thing is I want to draw a picture, another picture. Similar but different. Similar picture. U of X T is equal to 1/2. I'm supposed to put in V of X plus T and W of X minus T. So I have 1/2 F of X plus T plus F of X minus T. Switch them around. F minus T, F plus T. Plus 1/2 integral. Now I have to add this to this. Well, how about if I make this plus from X to 0? And then I add those, and then this has to go to X minus T, this one has to go to X plus T, and you add the two, so it's integral from X minus T to X plus T, G of X prime, DX prime, plus C1 plus C2, but those add to 0. Gorgeous. This is the D'Alembert formula. That's the D'Alembert formula. Lovely and simple. So, in particular, it makes sense for, I haven't ever really, well, I guess I've differentiated to derive it, but I don't even really need derivatives to write it down. I need like a continuous function or a bounded function. Yes? An integral, and cosine ct, which is evaluation at 2 points, plus t and minus t, gives you this expression. So there's a Fourier integral representation of that expression of 2. So that's the second proof of the D'Alembert formula. D'Alembert living 150 or so years before Fourier, but it's another second expression of D'Alembert formula. Okay, what I owe you is a picture. So the picture goes a bit like this. So you might say you really only need F, G, say, continuous in R for another sort of weak solution. I mean, you only need G to be integrable and F to be L infinity to have a bounded solution. I'll just say continuous just to make those an easy statement. So the picture I want to draw is, I guess I want to draw two pictures. Here's one, which is almost the same picture. Here's X and here's T. And I want to know what's the solution at this point, X, T. And I take an arbitrary point, say in the future, and I ask, what's the solution at that point? And we find the solution by reading this formula, which is, tells us you go backwards down two characteristics, one right moving, one left moving, and this is the point X minus T, 0, and this is the point X plus T, 0, and so the solution at this point, so I'll just rewrite it here, the solution at this point consists of, well, the F part is you average F at X minus T, and F of X plus T. So you take 1/2 times the 2-point values of F there and there. And that's the solution, that's the F contribution to the solution at that point above. But then you do more. You integrate between X minus T and X plus T, G of X prime, DX prime. So the position, the initial position contributes to the initial position here through just the average of 2-point values. And then the initial momentum contributes through this entire interval. You integrate over that interval, divided by 2. And that's the momentum contribution to the value of the solution at that point. Okay? So that's interesting. So what do you say? It's dependence. So it's dependence. of the xt, what it wants, the domain of dependence of xt for the wave equation is, well, for position, it's 2 points, x minus t and x plus t. And for position and for momentum, it's the interval, x minus t up to x plus t, as I've drawn it, and nothing more. Anything further away from the point x than t does not contribute to the solution at that point. It's another way of saying finite propagation speed. So I want to develop that further and draw another picture. And then we'll move on to a more, slightly more general wave equation. So, I want to talk about the principle of finite propagation speed. It's almost the same thing. Let's do it as follows. Let's specify f and g. So let's say that f and g are given such that the support of f and the support of g lie, say, in an interval minus r to r. I mean, let's just choose r to include both of their supports. And then look at time t. So at time t, could be positive, negative. Let's think for the future and think positively. Here I have minus r, and here I have r, and my data lies somewhere in here. And then I want to draw two characteristics. One, I shall want to draw four. This one going out, and this one going out. Any point outside here, when you look at its domain of dependence, as I've just discussed, it doesn't include any of the data. You only have zero out here. So one conclusion from this picture, at time t, the solution u is dead zero for x greater than, well, this is time t. When does it start being zero? This is the point r. This is the point r plus t. For x greater than r plus t, and x, of course, less than minus r minus t. Because the data has not propagated its characteristic to you yet. If you wait a little longer, bang, you'll hear the sonic boom. But you haven't waited that long yet. Okay, those are two characteristics. So that's the principle of finite propagation speed. Ultimately simple from the D'Alembert formula in one dimension. But let's now go one step further, and I want to talk about the strong principle. This is sometimes called Huygens principle, or the weak Huygens principle. So let's talk about the strong Huygens principle. The strong version, and it turns out the strong version only holds in odd dimensional spaces, even dimensional spacetimes. So I want to do that by drawing the other characteristic, which is like that and like that. All of them have slope 1. Oh, if it's speed c, not speed 1, then all of these characteristics have slope 1 upon c, speed c. Okay, so let's see if I have a point here or a point here, there's lots of action. Data comes by and you see the wave motion. But if you're close to the origin and you wait for well after the sonic boom has hit and passed on, what do you see at this point? Well, let's draw your characteristics. So what I want to say, this applies for t greater than, we only look for t greater than r, because this is the point r on the t-axis. or R over C, if I have speed C. And when T is greater than R, let's look at what contributions there are to the solution using the D'Alembert formula. So U of XT is equal to 1/2 F of X minus T plus F of X plus T, okay, plus an integral. This and this are zero, because those are those two points. They're outside the support. Okay? Secondly, there's an integral 1 upon 2, integral from X minus T to X plus T of G of X prime dx prime, which is the integral from here to here. But since I'm already out of support in that integral, I might as well say it's equal the integral, 1/2 the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, g of x prime dx prime, which is a constant. So up here, the solution is constant. Inside that light cone, starting from the point R0, the solution is constant. In the union of all the light cones, which start, you take any light cone which starts on the data, on the set in which the data has support, you can have interesting solution. But then again, you take light cones, you take any data outside that region again, so there's a V-shaped wedge in which there's an interesting solution. The solution here is zero, the solution here is zero, and the solution here is equal to constant. In particular, if the integral of g of x prime dx prime from minus infinity to minus infinity is equal to zero, that's zero total initial momentum, then the solution there is constant. Sorry, it's zero. Otherwise, it's just a constant. Zero. So that's character of solutions in the one-dimensional wave equation. Sorry?
I just don't see why.
You've only seen it in one dimension, and I've just said it will be true. It is true, and I will show you that it's true in all even dimensions. Propagation of finite propagation speed is true in all dimensions, but Huygens' principle is only in all odd dimensions. That's a good thing. If we lived in two dimensions, there's not a sharp Huygens' principle. So when you make a sonic boom, bang, you get the delta function hitting you, but then you have this rumbling effect that decays very slowly as that sonic boom goes off in space further from you, but there leaves a residual. It's very annoying in even dimensions. So a good thing we don't live on surfaces, but we live in actual three-dimensional bodies, at least for hearing. Otherwise, we'd be hearing what the cavemen still said, you know, rumbling around behind us. I'm going to stop for a break. It's just that time. let's start again with the wave equation. So, wave equation. T squared u minus, so plus nu equals zero. I want to rewrite it. So an elegant way of rewriting is as follows. So is as a first order system. A first order system of equations. So I want to write this as follows, that d by dt, let me make a bigger one, partial t of the vector u p, so I introduce a new function p, is equal to, well, p Laplacian u. Let's just check that down. So dtu is equal to p, so that's a dtu equals to p, and then dtp is equal to dt squared u is equal to Laplacian u. And I want to rewrite this as the following matrix. 0, the identity, minus the identity, 0. Then I have to put this p down here, and I have to put minus Laplacian u up here. And so I want to say this is a Hamiltonian system. So in particular, in finite dimensions, so in mechanics, so this is an analogy with mechanics. So in mechanics, you often have a position vector x and a momentum vector p. No, let me do this differently. Position vector q and momentum vector p, and often there's an energy h, which is a function of q and p, and then the equations of motion dictate that q dot p dot is equal to 0, 1, minus 1, 0, partial h, partial q, partial h, partial p. Very often this thing. And often h is even in terms of kinetic energy, which is a function of p, plus potential energy is a function of q. And very often, and then this reads the following, and even kinetic energy is very often 1/2 p squared, and then this reads the following way, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, well then d QH is equal to QV, and dPH is equal to P, which I can write as being P minus partial QV. And that saying Q dot is equal to P, P dot is equal to minus QH, and that's a way of writing mechanical systems, is Q double dot is equal to minus partial QV. Back again to here. So what I want to say is the wave equation is an infinite dimensional, what do you say, a continuum version of a mechanical system. But I have to give you h. So let's do h, and that's a function of u, and it's a functional of u and p. This is a real valued function, so it takes phase space, so h is a map from phase space to the reals. So what I need is a map from phase space to the reals. So it for me is 1/2 integral over Rn p squared. Let me do it this way. 1/2 p squared plus 1/2 gradient of u modulus squared dx. Now let's try this out. Let's take its derivatives. Take its derivatives. The Remember on day one I took the derivatives of a functional? Let's do that again. So what I need is the variation of h with respect to u. I'm going to do that in the w direction. So it's the following thing. You take h. So it's the following thing. You take h of, it's a function of u plus, let's say, epsilon w p, and then you take the epsilon derivative evaluated at epsilon equals 0. That's the directional derivative of h in with respect to u in the w direction. Okay? And now let's do this with our functional. So it's equal to, I'm going to do that with p first, so let's continue this. H dp of h in the q direction is equal to partial by partial epsilon equals 0, of h, now we leave u fixed, and we have p plus epsilon q. And if we plug into this second expression, I want to do this, and I want to do this, but the second one I decided was easier. So let's put that into our expression for h. It's 1 half p plus epsilon q squared plus 1 half grad u squared dx. Then I have to take d by d epsilon and take epsilon equal to 0. Everyone see what I'm going to get? Clearly, this has nothing to do with epsilon, so it goes out. And here, it's 1 half p squared, there's no epsilon, plus 1 half times 2 epsilon pq, d by d epsilon of that gives me pq, plus half epsilon squared q squared. Now, epsilon squared, its derivative is 2 epsilon, and evaluated at 0, it's 0, so that's all I get. This derivative, on the other hand, is the integral of 1 half p squared. That has nothing to do with epsilon, so that will go out. Plus 1 half grad u plus epsilon w dx. And by the same reasoning, when I take d by d epsilon at epsilon equals 0, by the same reasoning, I'm going to get the integral of grad u dot grad w, because of course this is a u squared term, a grad u squared term with an epsilon squared, and the middle term, which is the one that survives, is d by d epsilon equals 0 dx. And I want to integrate by parts. To say this is minus Laplace in u times w dx. So, from this, I want to read that the gradient of u of h with respect to u is minus Laplacian u, and the gradient of h with respect to p is equal to p. And then everyone knows somehow in their back of their mind that the gradient depends on the inner product. I'm using the L, depends on the metric. The metric is an inner product. This is the L2. Inner product. And so therefore, I want to rewrite this line as the following thing. It's the d by dt of a vector u p is equal to 0, the identity, minus the identity, 0. I'm rewriting this. All I did was algebra there, and now I want to write out this right-hand side. What is minus the gradient of u, minus Laplacian u? It's the gradient of h with respect to u. And what's p? It's the gradient of h with respect to p. And so that's, so this has the same form as this, where the only difference is the gradients are gradients of functionals over the Hilbert space. Okay? And this is a general principle. This is a general principle that a number in partial differential equations, including the wave equation, can be considered as infinite dimensional Hamiltonian systems. Now, there's a principle in Hamiltonian mechanics, which says that the Hamiltonian is conserved along the flow, at least for autonomous systems, that is, systems where the Hamiltonian is independent of time. So the Hamiltonian is sort of the principle. The principle is the conservation of the Hamiltonian. So that says, let's make that a principle of conservation, and let's make a proposition out of this. And I think it's proposition 3 today. I had 2 theorems. This is not new. I'm going to relate it to conservation of energy. I'm just saying you can view it from the terms of a Hamiltonian system. So I want to say it's solutions of, what's my equation number now? 9? Star. So I'll make this a 9. So solutions of 9 conserve H. And actually, this is 9, but that's the PDE version of this. So let's make this 10. Now I screwed up your notes because I wrote this one down first. So this is 9, and this is 10. But I want to keep this 9. Solutions of 9 conserve H. And let's try it. So here's the proof. It's a bit of a formal proof because I'm going to take derivatives where I don't necessarily have a right to, because I could be talking about weak solutions. But I just want to make a point. Yes, that's a question. These equations, this is equal to this, and this is equal to this. And then I slotted that one in a little place. So the proof is as follows. Let's try H of, our variables are U of T, oh, we're doing 9. So my variables are Q of T and P of T. And we think for the wave equation, Q of t is really supposed to be the value of u of x of t. It's, you know, this is a function u of x. It varies in some function space. Space of functions x, that's our phase space. And it's a curve in that phase space. It varies in time. Okay? But let's just do it. This is the Hamiltonian for a trajectory. And I want to see how the Hamiltonian changes along the trajectory. So that's, of course, using the chain rule. It says it's partial QH times Q dot plus partial PH times P dot. Now, using what Q dot and P dot are, I can say that this is the inner product of, how do I want to say this? It's a partial, yeah, it's inner product of the vector partial QH partial PH times the vector q dot p dot, but q dot p dot, according to that line 9, is 0, 1, minus 1, 0, partial qh, partial ph. So it's 0, identity, minus identity, 0, partial qh, partial ph, inner product. And this is sometimes called J. And it has the property that J transpose is equal to minus J. Q symmetric matrix. And we have the same vector on the left and on the right. So what happens when you have an inner product of a vector V with a skew symmetric matrix V? It is 0. So this is automatically 0. The same thing occurs for 10. It's just, instead of being vector product in, say, I applied up there, it's just simply R or 2n a Euclidean space. Here, I'm actually doing it in a function space, but it's the same proof. In fact, this was our alternate proof of the conservation of energy. So this is not analogous to, it is, if we did this, it is the alternate proof of the conservation of energy. This is our alternate proof, which I've already given you, of energy conservation. Good. So, while we're on the subject, are there other equations around that have similar principles? So let's look at other equations for a bit. Other, what you might say, Hamiltonian PDE. So let me make 8, 9, 10, how about 11? Is I could make a nonlinear wave equation. So I'm going to, in the mode where I'm just going to give a few examples. It looks of this form. I'm going to take a Hamiltonian. Let me start by the Hamilton by just giving the Hamiltonian. That's an interesting thing to do. I'm going to use the same kinetic energy as the wave equation I have up there, which is a function p of x, will also depend on t, and the kinetic energy is half p squared. But now I want to give a different potential energy, half grad u squared, perhaps, plus maybe a function g of u. And this g could also depend on x, I guess. Let's look at the gradient of h. Well, that has two components at the point up. It has two components, the u component and the p component. Well, the p component, I'm going to put it second, is p because it's the same for the same reason as before. We've already calculated. The u component has a minus Laplacian u because that's the gradient of this term, but it also has the gradient of the integral of g of x of u dx. What's the gradient of that? It's just g prime, where prime means the u derivative of g, so plus g sub u, the u partial, I'll do it this way, the u partial derivative of g evaluated at x, u. And I can then write a wave equation, which is d by dt of the vector u p is equal to j, that is 0, the identity, minus the identity 0, gradient of h, and if I write that out using what we the information we have on the board, I find that d by dt squared, because p dot is equal to u, u dot is equal to, etc. So d by dt squared of u is equal to Laplacian u minus the u derivative of g of x and u. So that's what I want to call my equation 11. It's almost saying from Hamilton's principles you derive a monolinear wave equation. The reason it's not is because I just freely wrote down a somewhat arbitrary Hamiltonian, knowing what my former teacher used to say, malice aforethought, what was going to come out. But let's do another one. So this is now, that's example one. Here's example one. Let's do another example. Let's make example two as a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Well, I'm going to do it this way. I'm just going to specify what the Hamiltonian is. And it's going to be a function of the wave. It's a functional of the wave function C, famous letter C. It's also a functional of C bar, of course. And I'm just going to write it down as integral of 1 half modulus of grad C squared. C is complex valued. Plus some potential energy, I'm going to call it Q of x, C, and C bar, dx. Iterate over, we're in some Rn dimension. I've not paid much attention to which dimension we're in. It's a bit formal stuff we're doing. And then I want, given my first example in what you might call Darboux coordinates, meaning that this skew symmetric matrix here is of that exactly that form, 0 identity minus identity 0 on two copies of a Hilbert space. So you might say this is Darboux coordinates. Here it's complex coordinates, a little bit different, but nonetheless I want to have it the same. I want to pursue the same analogy. What I want to do is take the gradient, the variation with respect to C bar of H. And in some sense, these are treated as independent variables. And so the C bar gradient only differentiates with respect to C bar. So that's equal to, I'll do it in a phi bar direction, is equal to 1/2 grad C dot grad phi bar plus the C bar gradient of Q evaluated at the point X C C bar times phi bar dx. And I want to say, actually I want to do quantum mechanics. So Q C is complex. Q, I want, then, in general, it's a function of x and then two complex numbers, c and c bar. So what I want to have is the property that q is a function of x, one complex number, another complex number. And I want it to be with the property that when I put x, when I put z in and I put the z bar, the same complex number, and I bar it and put it in, I want that to be real. And then we're in the setting where we're doing quantum, nonlinear quantum mechanics. Otherwise, we're not. But from here, of course, we can read off the gradient because I integrate by parts. It's 1/2 minus Laplacian C. Oh, sorry. It's minus 1/2 Laplacian C plus partial C bar Q integrated against phi bar dx. And so, therefore, we can read off this is the gradient d c bar of h. And now I want to give you the equations of motion, which are the time derivative of c is equal to, well, I want it to be j gradient of h, but I'm going to say, so I have to specify what j is. J for me is going to be I, multiplication by the I. And we've just computed what the gradient with respect to C bar is of H, and that's going to be equal to minus 1/2 Laplacian C plus partial C bar of Q. And that's my second example. So that's equation 12. I'm going to rewrite it here just because it got a little bit disorderly there. And I'm going to put the I onto the right-hand side. So I d by dt of C is equal to 1/2 Laplacian C minus partial C bar Q of X C C bar. I might say that very often, quantum mechanics is a funny place where phase actually plays a role. Very often phase, complex phase, for physical reasons, should play no role. But here the phase plays a role. But under constant changes of phase, that's a gauge transformation, and it doesn't enter. So often, Q is Q of X, but just of the modulus of C squared. It certainly satisfies this. This is going to be a ZW bar, so when you put W is equal to Z, you get mod Z squared. And then this has a particular form. That implies something special about that, that in fact this would be Q is equal to what I'll say is G mod C squared. And so then this becomes minus G prime of X and mod C squared C. That's what goes in that place. And that's often what you see. And even often what you see is this is C squared. And that's called the cubic Schrodinger equation. But all of them constitute valid equations for in quantum mechanics. At least the mathematicians could be a mathematician's form of quantum mechanics. Example 3, the quarter vector Ries equation. And all I'm doing is going through a little recitative of several equations which have the same form as the nonlinear wave equation in a certain way. Okay? And so this is also given as a Hamiltonian, H, and it's a function, I think there's, I'll call the, it's going to be a functional of Q, and the Hamiltonian is, so this is X, this is special, it's X is going to be R1, and Q is going to be a real function. And the Hamiltonian is going to be 1/2 dxq squared. But for funny reasons, I want it 1/12. So just take 1/6 of what you thought I was going to write. Yes? I have to have, remember the skew symmetry? The skew symmetry here? I'm allowed to choose any skew symmetric operator I want, almost. I want non-degenerate skew symmetric. Maybe it should satisfy some slightly more condition, slightly larger condition that I want to mention. Multiplication by I is a perfectly good Hermitian anti-symmetric operation. I bar is minus I. That's what you want, that minus sign. So it's up to me. I'm allowed to choose, so I chose I. Where did it come? No, it's a different J. It's just a J. I just chose a different J. Same inner product, same gradient, different J.
And you chose it to look like the classical Schrodinger.
I chose it so it recovered. This is the J that you choose to make quantum mechanics. You also, in this, on this blackboard, I also could have complexified my phase space, and there I could have made, but that's next year when I'm going to teach Hamiltonian mechanics, and not this year where I'm teaching PDE. So you have to have a little patience.
Where do you teach your Hamiltonian?
Separate question. Talk about that later. Okay, let me see. I haven't finished this, have I? Do I need a plus or a minus? I'll just put plus. I'm going to talk about a generalized KdV equation. I just put a plus G of Q, plain old G. And then, as above, let's take its gradient. Now we're getting good at taking gradients. So the Q derivative of H is equal to, let's just read it off, 2 and 12, I get a 1/6. dxq dx, the variation, I have to integrate by parts, minus 1/6 dx squared Q. Plus G, all I get is plus G sub Q of Q. That's the variation. That's the gradient of H. You agree with me? And now let's write down Hamilton's equation. So I want, so we were talking about choosing J. I'm now going to choose J to be D by DX, partial by partial X. Perfectly good skew symmetric operator. A little degenerate, bide with me. The non-classical symplectic structure. Then I have my equations of motion, and this is 13, which is d by dt of q is equal to j d by dx of minus 1/6 dx squared q plus g of q of q. And if you allow me to just pass all those derivatives in, this d squared turns into a d cubed. And here I have to differentiate the nonlinearity. And that's a form of the KdV equation. Generally, G of Q turns out to be Q cubed. I think a third Q cubed is what people find. But same material. This is the usual KDV. This is what Kordovec and DeRieve wrote down. This is the real, the true case. Okay, it's just a class of interesting problems. Turns out that if you have a third Q cubed or a fourth Q fourth, these turn out to be completely integrable Hamiltonian systems. A whole subject in its own right, which I'm not going to talk about this year, probably nor next, but it's interesting in its own right. So, let's move on. So much material to cover, so little time. So let me tell you the index of the next two topics, but time is running out, so I can only do one of them, and I'm going to choose that right now. My index of the next two topics are what are the group invariance properties of the wave equation? So back to the wave equation. So the group of symmetries, the symmetries of the wave equation. I should say the wave operator. And the second one is going to be, I wanted to give you a general proof of finite propagation speed, but I wanted to do it in a not necessarily, that can be derived in a variety of ways. And I wanted to do it in a way which exploited the Fourier transform and used essentially what's called Paley-Wiener theory. So that one allows us to, that allows us, one, to prove finite propagation speed, and two, learn Paley-Wiener theory. I'm going to put that off till next time. And I'm sorry I didn't finish all in this particular slot, time slot. Instead, I'm just going to talk about symmetries of the wave equation. That's what we'll do now. So remember, this is up to you, right, to find the symmetries of the Laplace's equation. So recall that Laplacian is invariant. Laplacian, which is, right, the sum of partial x j squared, j equals 1 to n, is invariant under rotations. Under translations and rotations. I guess also reflections. I wanted to ask the same question of the wave operator. So what about the wave operator? How about the wave operator? Well, let's see. So there's dt squared minus Laplacian with respect to x. And this is a solution of the wave equation. That, and this is the wave operator. A lot of people write box u. And the box is called the D'Alembertian. So let's think for the remaining 10 minutes about its invariances. What's the invariant? By the way, so the translations or rotations, those are the what's it called? A group of Euclidean symmetries. What's the name of it? It's not the Galilean transformations, because you also can move into a moving, put it in a new moving frame. But here we don't talk about time. What's the name of that group? I don't know. Nobody knows. Translations and rotations. If it has a fancy name, I'm sure. Somebody, some dead mathematician's name, I can't remember. Sorry? Poincaré. I'm not so sure. I don't think so. In any case, so what's the name of the invariant group of invariants for the D'Alembertian? The Lorentz group. So what's, we're trying to discover the Lorentz group. So I want to start by defining a hyperbolic rotation. So define a hyperbolic rotation. And I want to do it I don't want to do it in all n variables, because it gets slightly clumsy, so I'm going to be clever and just do it in x1t. And if I do this, then I think it'll come out neater than if I do them all. Okay? So So what I'm doing is here's one of the variables, one of the x variables, that's x1, and here's t, and here are all the other x variables, let's call, I don't know, call it x prime, all the rest, and I'm just going to move x1 and t around and leave the others invariant for the moment, okay? And I want to do the following. So in the new variable, t prime x prime is equal to not the cosine, but the cosh, the hyperbolic cosine, cosh an angle c, sinh an angle c, sinh an angle c, and cosh, plus, in both cases, x t. I guess we used to call these rotations r, this is a hyperbolic rotation, I'll call it h of x t. And let's do a couple of things. Check the determinant of h is equal to, thanks, 1. And h inverse, we switched what ordering? Oh, damn. Drat. Tx. That's what I meant. And my notes say Tx. And so it's me, it's my wiring which is screwed up. Okay, and H inverse is equal to H of minus P. Interesting. Okay, so now what happens to Dx? Dt, partial T, partial X1. Equals partial t prime partial x1 prime. Oh, this is going to be x1s. So I'm only rotating in the x1 plane, right? And this is a cosh c sinh c sinh c cosh c. And so I could have written this, I guess, as h of c against this t prime x1 prime. And so let's define the Lorentz group. So define the Lorentz group. I don't know. I don't have any groups on the board, so let's make it a curly L. I won't have many of these. It's going to be equal to. Well, let me see. Let me change lines. It's going to. You do the following thing. You're allowed any rotation of space. So you keep T alone, and then you leave all these X, and then these are zeros. Then you're allowed any rotation of n space. N by n rotation, but you allow that to. You can do that to any h 2 by 2, because we just did a 2 by 2 mixing of x and t, x1 and t1, and then you leave these alone and you leave this the identity. And then you just take all rotations, that's a group, you take all of these hyperbolic rotations, that's a group, and you make a group out of all possible combinations of such. Okay? So in particular, you could have rotated, and I guess you should do it in the other order too, because it's a group, you're allowed to invert. So you could have rotated and did a hyperbolic rotation in any other x variable. Oh, I forgot to do this. I forgot to do one thing, which is, what am I allowed to take a vector to? So a vector here under hyperbolic rotation can go anywhere inside the light cone by some h, but it can't ever be taken out of the light cone. And a vector here can be taken anywhere out of the light cone by a hyperbolic rotation h. Another one, this is h1, this is maybe h0, but it can't be taken into the light cone. So there's an interesting cone that you cannot, that is left invariant by all such L's. Okay? Well, it's not my goal to discuss this in depth, but just to say what it is, and I want to just say one principal thing, which I guess I'll do on this blackboard. So that's a proposition, and I think it's our proposition 4, which is Lorentz transformations leave the wave operator, that is the D'Alembertian, invariant. So let's see, I guess we really only have to check 2 things. And one is we have to check that this kind of operation will leave the wave operator invariant. But since this only affects the Laplacian, and you guys have already checked this for me, we don't even have to do that. We have to worry about what these 2 by 2 blocks mixing T and X1 do, and then we'll be done. So let's do that, and I'm going to do that in the following way. So here's the proof. We have to study dT squared minus Laplacian X operating on F, and I want to write that in the following way. Partial T, partial X, 1, 0, 0, now I have an n by n identity, minus n by n identity, operating on dt dx. That's the wave operator, acting on F. This is n plus 1 by 1, this is n plus 1 by f plus 1, this is 1 by n plus 1, so the thing is a scalar operator in the end. Okay? We were also able to write Laplacian is equal to dx1 up to dxn, the identity dx1 up to dxn, in these variables, which is the lower n by n block, by the way. And then let's do the transformation. Now transform. So let's see what we have to do. I have to look at dt prime dx1 prime dx... Oh, drat. My notation is screwed up. dx2 prime is the same as dx2. So I'm actually doing this transformation. I'm doing this one. We already checked this one, and I have to check this one. So I'm really just doing the H. So dx2 through dxn is left alone. And now I have to do this. H transpose the 2 by 2 bit, and the I, n minus 1 by n minus 1, is left alone, times... Then I have to do this bit here, which is 1, minus the identity n by n. And then I have to put this. This is this under the transformation rules. And now I have to write what this is under the transformation rules, which is h 2 by 2 I n by 1 n minus 1 by n minus 1. And I squeeze in the end dt prime, dx1 prime, and then, of course, the old dx2 through dxn. Right? dt prime, dx1 prime are the things that are being having a hyperbolic rotation. And so what we really have to do is this is a plus 1, this is a minus 1. This otherwise is block form. ht on that 2 by 2 block. H 2 by 2 again, and I have to check that. So what we have to check is, so we have to see the result and see that we get this back again with a T prime and an X prime. So what we really have to check is this thing, H transpose 1, 0, 0, minus 1, H, where H is one of these HVs. Because everything else is just left alone by this matrix operation. And let's do that. So it's equal to cosh. Oh, I have a clever notation. I'm going to write this as CH for cosh, SH for cinch, SH for cinch, CH for cosh. One, I hope it works out. I'm getting nervous. CH, SH, SH, CH. And you do it, and it's going to be CH squared minus SH squared, 0, 0, SH squared minus CH squared, just doing the algebra. And lo and behold, it's equal to 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So what we've done is we just calculated these n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrix operations, and we find that it's equal to 1 minus 1, that's that last one, times the identity here. So it's actually equal to dt prime, dx1 prime, dx2, etc., to 1 minus the identity times dt prime, dx1 prime, dx2, dxn, which is the Dalibertian. That's equal to the Dalibertian in the t prime x prime variables. So, well, it was a little bit fast, but that's the Lorentz invariance of the wave operator, and I just want to finish by drawing a picture. So the wave operator transforms to the wave operator. I just want to finish by drawing a picture. I could have assigned that as a problem set. You guys don't have any problems. I guess you don't need any problems. That's all right. So let's just do the following. The x equals 0. That is the t hyperplane. Let's just look at this. Here's x1. And here's t. So the x equals 0, that's the t axis. X equals 0, the t axis, corresponds to x1 prime is equal to cinch c t. T prime is equal to cosh c t. So this gets rotated to here. And then let's look at x1 prime over t prime is equal to the tanh c, tanh c. And let's call that a tanh, hyperbolic tangent, goes between 0 when v equals 0 and, anyone have a graph of a hyperbolic tangent in their mind? And 1. So this is, this I want to call V, where 0 is less than or equal to V. Actually, minus 1 is less than or equal to V, is less than or equal to plus 1. That's what defines the light cone. You can move the t-axis between, to have original, into a new line whose original slope is from between minus 1 and plus 1. And then doing this, then we find that cinch of C was equal to V over 1 minus V squared, and cosh of C is 1 over root 1 minus V squared. And so we could have written the original transformation in terms of 1 over root 1 minus V squared. I'm getting messy because I'm trying to speed up, but I shouldn't do that. H is equal to, I'm trying to make it look like a classical Lorentz transformation. 1 minus v squared, minus v over root 1 minus v squared, minus v over root 1 minus v squared, and then 1 over root 1 minus v squared. I think textbooks will look a little bit more like this. So these are the classic Lorentz transformations. Lorentz transformations. And let me stop here. Oh, one more thing. I'm sorry. This could be a problem set. Ah, finally a problem set. Problem set number 7, which is check that the light cone is left invariant by Lorentz transformations. So the light cone, which is x equals t. So we're in n dimensions. Here's x1. Here's all the other xj's. Here's t. There's a cone here, which I've just defined, but we knew it was sitting there all along. X equals t. And I want you to show that, what can I say? It's all the xt. All the xt such that x squared minus t squared equals 0. Same thing as I just wrote. But show that L leaves this invariant. That's the problem. So it's as I drew, here's the light cone. And you can move t prime around anywhere here, and if you take a limit, c heading off to infinity, you can get this to approach that line. For any finite c, you never hit it. But if you start with any vector in here, then it's left in there by such transformations. I think that's enough for the day.